Hello, and a warm welcome to the Reform Party podcast. My guest today, I haven't had on the podcast for about 6 months, but he is returning, and it's Mr. Nick Goulding, the chairman of Crewe & Nantwich Reform. Hello, Nick.
Good morning to you.
So, as I say, it's been about 6 months since we did our first podcast, which went very well, I think, and was well received. So I just wanted perhaps if we could start by going through some of the things that have happened in the interim, because 6 months is a long time in politics, isn't it?
Well, it particularly so with reform, because since then we have won the by-election in Runcorn. We have continued our upward trajectory in the polls. Membership numbers have continued up. Our branches have become much more solid and capable. And they proved that in May in delivering that sweep of councils that we managed to win and on which the party is now building.
Yes, it's been a fantastic upward trajectory, hasn't it? I mean, I looked at what the poll figures were back in January, and then we were polling around about 24% on average, and we're now up to around about 30%. So, I mean, 6 points in 6 months is a huge increase in our results.
It certainly is, and in fact, on all of the polls since about 4 months ago, of all the most reputed pollsters, there may be the odd one that doesn't come in that list, but of all the mainstream pollsters, we have come in first place on voting intention in every occasion. The margin has varied between 2% above the next party to 12% above the next party. But it is typically around 6 to 8% above the party in second place. And for a challenger party, which only, I know we started a couple of years before that, but in reality, only really got its teeth into moving forward just on a year ago now, that is a spectacular position to be in the polls.
And tell me, Nick, do you think it's because we are doing things very well, that we are doing everything right? Or do you think it's just that the other parties are doing absolutely everything wrong?
Well, I mean, all of the above. I mean, every time you turn, the other parties confirm people in their negative impression of them. Mm. The Conservative Party is in a hole and it's digging away furiously. And the Labour Party seems to be trying to pull the walls down on top of itself. It's difficult to think of, if we had in our wildest dreams, how can you make the governing party and the official opposition less popular? Is there anything we could have thought up that they haven't already done to themselves? I rather suspect not. But that's not to detract from the other side of the equation, because you haven't merely got to be on the field, but you've got to be delivering the ball into the back of the net. And when I look at the change in the party, in how well organised we are, the detailed campaigning work that so many branches, so many members do up and down the country, delivering leaflets, knocking on doors, and getting councillors elected, both in the big elections in May, but also never a week goes by when, if you look at the news on the Friday morning, Reform have picked up another two or three council seats without exception. We have certainly picked up more council seats since May the 1st than any other party. The Liberal Democrats have picked up a number, but the bulk of the Liberal Democrat seats have been where they've held a seat they held before, where ours are all new. And both Labour and Conservative have been losing, and not merely losing a little bit, they've been losing really badly. So in both cases, where they were number one before, sitting on maybe 40 or even 50% of the vote, you're seeing Reform coming through on maybe 40-odd percent. And to take an example, Labour goes from 50% down to 15%. They lose some vote to reform, but they also lose vote to Green and, in the appropriate places, Liberal Democrats.
And this new party is not going to help them either, is it? This Corbyn party.
It certainly isn't. And we have to remember that Keir Starmer had fewer votes when he was elected landslide last year than Jeremy Corbyn received on either of his two general elections. Now, in terms of percentages, he got slightly more than Jeremy Corbyn on one election, but slightly less than on the other. But the absolute number of votes, Jeremy Corbyn persuaded more people to vote for him than Starmer and his team managed to persuade to vote for them. And I think that's very telling.
Absolutely. But the jewel in the crown, if you like, and I know you were quite heavily involved in it, was Sarah Pochin's win in Runcorn, wasn't it? And I was down there one day doing a podcast or canvassing or whatever, and I remember you coming along in your taxi, tooting your horn, and give me a fright. But it
Yes,
was
I mean, I was there not quite every day, but 6 days a week. I wasn't putting in a whole day every time, but 2 hours one day, 6 hours another day, 4 hours another day. I was out there, and I was out there with local members knocking on the doors, listening to the voters of Runcorn, and it was very clear to me that in those working class areas, particularly where the government was putting asylum seekers or similar into houses on the streets that everyone else was living on, that they really were giving no truck to the government. And in fact, the effect we saw in Runcorn was that as soon as an old person passed away, they were replaced by half a dozen undocumented migrants put in there by the council. So the population in those close-knit working class areas was being deeply disrupted by the government's own choices. And they did make a thing about closing down a big asylum hotel
Yeah,
on
that's
the
right.
outskirts of Runcorn. But A, it's still there. And B, in many ways, although people don't like asylum hotels, they're less disliked than those HMOs where you get people in the same street. And so groups of young males, as they describe them, of fighting age is the general sort of term that people use, hanging around schools, hanging around where women are coming back from their shopping. And they may not intend to do this, but they do create a threatening environment, and it causes enormous concern amongst the female population. And I do think that that is really driving the increase of the female vote. And in fact, if you look at the polls, Reform is clearly, by a long way, the party of the C2DE element of the population. And that means the working class, in all its guises, has solidly made the choice for reform. And Labour has been withdrawing to all those ABC, well-heeled public sector bureaucrats, North London, Islington. It's a caricature, but that's where the core Labour vote is.
And tell me, Nick, in your own branch, are these C2D constituents, are they represented in the branch structure? Because my feeling is I get the impression that whilst we have got a lot of support in ex-Labour areas, that the people who are more involved in my branch tend to be more from the Conservative side.
Well, I think it does depend on where your branch is. So, as I travel around the Northwest to different branch meetings, which I do, you can see the clear difference between the former Conservative seats and the Labour seats. If you look at Crewe and Nantwich, which is the branch that I have the honour to be the chairman of, as the population has gone up in Crewe, as they build more housing estates, the boundary of Crewe and Nantwich has been drawn back by the boundary commissioners closer and closer. So now it doesn't even include all the built-up area. So there is virtually no country area in the Crewe and Nantwich constituency. The bits that used to be are now in other constituencies. And on our branch committee, without exception, except for myself, all of the officers are in working class backgrounds who have lived in Crewe, particularly their whole life, whose families have lived there, and who have deep roots in the community. And that's why, if you look at the various polls that break down the distribution of those national polling figures, in Crewe now, we are showing support for reform in the 40%.
Good.
So you've got a clear gap of maybe 15% in front of Labour, and the Conservatives trailing 10 or 15% behind Labour. So on the analysis of the constituency, Crewe now shows as likely reform rather than reform marginal, or whatever the other descriptions are. And that's really because the electorate in Crewe very much reflects that working class community, which, as I said, has sent a clear message that they have no truck with Labour anymore.
Well, that's very good to hear, because one of my concerns is that as we move forward and get more towards the next general election, is that there will be attempts by some to paint us as conservative light, you know, people, the people who would previously voted conservative vote for us now. And I know that's not the case in reform, but I'm concerned that that will be the portrayal.
Well, there is that possibility. But I have to say, there always was an element of the Conservative support that, particularly on the cultural issues, was very much aligned, not least because it was a predominant view across the whole country with the view that the working class took. I mean, I remember back in the 70s and 80s, I could have a conversation with Labour politicians. And although I was a Conservative, I knew I shared a whole set of common underlying values. And I knew that while I might not agree with their economic policies, I never questioned their commitment to the country and the values of the people of the country. And so those elements of the Conservative Party, which share that approach, find it easy to align and empathise with exactly the centre point of where those working class voters feel they have been abandoned.
Well, I was slightly concerned, I think I probably said to you at the time, with the selection of our candidate in Runcorn, Sarah Pochin, who was ex-Conservative, ex-mayor, a magistrate and so on. It seemed to me at the time that she was the wrong sort of choice for what is, in Runcorn, a very solid working class constituency. I'm glad to say she got in, and I have to say that having got in, she's been proving herself to be a fantastic MP, don't you think?
I think at national level, she has been exceptional. She does change the balance of our team in Westminster and presents an image that unsettles the preconceptions of people who want to criticise us. Having a lady there is important. And she's also someone who is growing in stature in her ability to present herself on the media. And she is now an outstanding performer in that regard. So it's not a coincidence that she gets put forward by the party for such a high proportion of those interviews.
Yeah.
But I should also say, and I have quite a lot of contacts in the Runcorn constituency, that she is going down really well with the outspoken way she's standing up for her constituents on these sorts of core issues. And I suspect that if the election were to be rerun, her vote, based on what she has done as MP, would be significantly higher than it was before, because I suspect some people did have a question mark over that background. But my experience is that those people who had that question mark have been very favorably impressed with what she's actually delivering. And so I think she's nailing herself on for re-election at the general election as the continued Member of Parliament for the Runcorn and Helsby constituency.
Well, I agree with you, and I was very, very pleased to have been proved wrong about her in terms of the her candidature. And she's been great. I saw her on the other day doing a thing on the carbon capture and storage program, part of which is actually in Runcorn. It's the incinerator plant, I think, which is connected to it. And this is something which, as you know, I and my colleagues in Wirral have been starting to really kick up about, because we think it's a disgrace. So I was pleased to see that she was on our side on that one.
Yes, I mean, I don't know if you watch it at all, but there is a member of Reform who runs a blog that is centered very much on the Runcorn constituency called Cheshire Cat Musings.
No, I haven't seen
And
that.
well, it's worth a look, because he does bring the voice of the working class electors of Runcorn. And it was interesting watching him through the by-election, and his commentary on the performance of his new MP. And he takes very much the view which I have just expressed to you, and which I've heard from other people. But if you want to hear it from the mouth of a ordinary Reform member who is a constituent of Sarah Pochin, then Cheshire Cat Musings is a good, which you can get on YouTube. It's a good blog post to listen to.
I'll put a link to it in the show notes for this podcast, so people can go and find it.
I mean, he's done a recent one on why the Conservatives are toast, and so that's a good one to start with.
Right, okay, I'll do that. Having said all the good things that have happened, there have been a few blips on the way in the last 6 months. The first of these was the split and the antics with the Rupert Lowe affair. What was your view on that?
Well, I think it's going to work out in our interests for the reason I will now outline. Now, I agree with much of what Rupert Lowe says on policy. I also agree with what much of what Ben Habib, who went to my school, I should say, has to say about policy. He was, however, junior to me, a year or two younger, but there you go.
What was this rugby, was it?
This was rugby school, yes.
Yeah.
And in both of those cases, I think they've missed the forest for the trees. Neither of them have proved themselves to be team players, and we need to be a team. In any political party, it's possible to take exception to this policy or that policy. But if you've got an individual who's all me, and my particular thing must be the dominant one, and they're not prepared to listen to the leader, and they're not, and they're prepared to go out and actively criticize the leader, it's not right they should continue in the party. And on some of the issues, although I say I broadly agree with them, on some of them, I think they push the envelope further than it needs to be pushed in a way that is undermining for the party, because we have to position ourselves to secure a sufficient vote to deliver an overall majority. And the sort of language which both of those gentlemen have used is not the sort of language which is likely to help us in that regard. And by achieving a separation from that sort of language and making plain that reform sits on the middle of the new centre ground of British politics, then I think that that is helpful for us. I think they both made wrong choices and they will become a footnote of history.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think the way particularly Rupert Lowe went about it, whereby he publicly undermined the leadership in a newspaper article, that, you know, it was just the wrong way to. If he did have differences, he should have stayed in the party and talked them through and settled them. But the problem is, when somebody's got a massive ego and they can't bring themselves to do that, it is a problem. And as you say, he would never have been a team player. And there are quite a number that fall into that category, unfortunately.
And just to add to what you said, he needed to be able to swallow not getting his way on certain issues.
Mm.
And he needed to accept that there can only be one leader in a party. If you have a party where there are multiple different leaders pulling the party in different directions, then that party will not prosper. And the fact that he couldn't recognise that made him unfit to be in the party.
Yep. You said that we were successful in the councils, and we were, and I had Nigel Evans on here a few weeks ago and talking to him about how things had started off in Lancashire. What's your impression of how the councils have begun?
I think they've taken a very sensible approach. They haven't arrived like a bull in a china shop and turned everything upside down without thinking. They've taken the pause to consider the way forward to deliver. They know that they've got 3+ years to make that change. And a change that's delivered in a considered way and will be lasting is much better than something that wrecks everything before you start to build it up again. They have only just started the process of going through all of the expenditure. The Doge team still has to get into many of the councils, and I know in some of them they still have to pass the necessary resolutions to allow the Doge team in, and that will be phased through. And of course, as the Doge team, working in conjunction with the elected councillors from reform in those particular authorities, build up more knowledge, and we see that we can make these savings in authority A, there's a very high probability that we can also make the same savings in authorities C, D, and E.
Absolutely.
So I think the way that those councillors have chosen to go is a model of how we need to be looking as we go forward. Next year, when we take another swathe of councils, I suspect we will be able to move faster. And the reason we will be able to move faster is because they will be treading in the steps of the ones who took control of the authorities this year.
Mm-hmm.
And the party will be making sure that those people who will be in control of the new authorities have the resources to be able to understand that and have the mentoring and the backing of the people who've been through the difficult process of the first year. I mean, I particularly take my hat off to those where we did very well, but not quite well enough to get an absolute majority. And you can see a maturity in the way they handle their relationships with other parties, which bodes really well. Now, of course, there have been one or two councillors that found that ill health or family commitments, and maybe they weren't being expecting to be elected in that particular ward, mean that a handful, and it is literally a handful of councillors, have dropped out since their election. But firstly, that happens with all the parties all the time, particularly if there's a landslide, because you get an increasing number of people who are elected who weren't expecting to get elected. And the fact that we have had relatively little of that and it's caused relatively little disruption speaks volumes about the effectiveness of our vetting and the quality of the people that we've had elected. If you look at the media and you see the absence of stories about this scandal about a reform councillor or that scandal about a reform councillor, they're largely absent. And there are certainly no more of those sort of stories than there are about Labour councillors who are in on remand for trying to strangle their wife, or Conservative Party councillors who've been fingered for some element of corruption. And so the media choose not to report those other stories, even though there are actually more of those stories than there are about ours. And you can be sure that if there was any of our elected councillors who were vulnerable from that sort of point of view, it would have been trumpeted to the four winds. And the fact that it's not been trumpeted to the four winds tells you, without great examination, that we got it right on that vetting, and that we've got a set of councillors who can deliver and are there for the right reasons to deliver for their local communities. And so I am very pleased with the progress so far, but there is that 3 years to go, and I expect to see a constant drip of stories as to how those reform councils are making incremental improvements across whole ranges of areas, and as they think more about it and they liaise with each other, those opportunities will come to the fore and be spread amongst them. And the whole of local government, by the time we've cleared out a lot more councils, will be made better by that, which is to the interest of the country as a whole.
Well, I mean, I know by looking at the quality of the council candidate that we have recruited to stand for our council, the quality of them is fantastic, and they really are good people. And you say that there have been fewer scandals amongst the new reform councils than councillors than you would have expected if there'd been Labour, but it's because they're ordinary people, and most ordinary people aren't don't have their fingers in the till or have sexual peccadillo. So that's because they're normal people that we don't have these things.
I very much agree with you. I mean, I'd also like to particularly pick out that exceptional young man who, as a deputy leader, had to step forward when the leader stepped down for ill health and take on the mantle of interim leader. He's now been
Elected leader.
approved. Well, he's been approved by our group, but I believe within the next week or so, he will be in front of the full council to confirm. It does require the votes, because they're a minority, of a certain number of the Conservatives. But he is such an impressive young man who shows all the best things about the next generation. And when I've heard him speaking, he shows a maturity far beyond his years, and someone who has great promise for the future, but in the short run, will be delivering for his local community.
Good. Okay, let's just move on a little bit. The big story of the last week or so has was been this terrible scandal with the Afghan interpreters and so on. Am I right in saying that your military service ended before Afghanistan? You weren't involved in
No,
Afghanistan.
Afghanistan was beginning to kick off as I was in Iraq. And I know plenty of people who've been out and served in Afghanistan. I mean, it is an appalling story. It's an appalling story from all sorts of reasons. Not least that it's not entirely clear how much thought they gave to the list, because many of the people on the list, it's not clear that they really were alongside us. And the other thing I'd say about that is, while I do have sympathy for particularly the interpreters that were directly working alongside our troops, and putting themselves at risk because of that association, many of these people were in the Afghan armed forces and they lost the war. We can't take the whole Afghan army. There were, we're now looking at getting on for 100,000. The Afghan army was 300,000 or 400,000 people. And, where do you stop taking responsibility? The other thing I'd say, by contrast to Ukraine, and this might sound harsh, but the ultimate reason that the Taliban took control in Afghanistan is that the people on the other side were not prepared to put up the fight to save their own country. And ultimately, we were there to assist them, not to fight the war for them. They were given millions of pounds worth of training, millions of pounds worth of equipment, both by ourselves and by the Americans. And the contrast with them and the Ukrainians is stark. The Ukrainians have been given resources and they've used it to take the fight back to the enemy. The Afghan army gave up and ran away.
Yeah.
And countries need to take responsibility for their own security. Yes, if they're our allies, if they're sticking up for themselves, I think we should help them. But if they're not prepared to do that themselves, then I have less sympathy.
No matter how terrible this Afghan scandal is, in my view, one of the things about it is that we should never have been in there in the first place. You know, that we went into something where we had went into a war that we had no real understanding of why we were going into it and no real plan to get out of it. And that was the real disaster.
The whole thing was clearly a disaster at the end, not least the manner of our leaving it. I do think we had some legitimate objectives, but I think we were ill-focused on those objectives and we ended up chasing the wrong objectives. I think that we did need to pursue Al-Qaeda. We needed to ensure that Afghanistan wasn't a safe haven for international terrorism. And I think we had legitimate concerns about the drug trade. But once we started trying to change the approach to Afghan ministries towards gender equality and human rights and so on, yes, of course, they're important. But they're important for us in our country to deliver according to our culture. If we go to another country with our perceptions and attempt to dictate to them how they should run their country, and we are proposing something that's a direct variance to their established culture, and they have no time to adjust to that, and we bring in planes and soldiers of a foreign nature, we're asking for trouble. And indeed, we got trouble. And we got to the point where, whatever the Afghan government said, individual Afghans were not prepared to fight for the society that we'd imposed on them in terms of those gender, female education and et cetera, which I agree with. I mean, I'm all for female education, but I am British. I'm for female education and emancipation in England. What they do in Afghanistan is the business of the Afghan population. They need to come to their own settlement.
Yeah.
Now, I think...
Yeah, in a sense, our going out there and trying to impose a Western liberal democracy in that country has got no more validity than the Muslims coming in trying to impose Sharia law in this country.
Yes, and it's wrong in every level. Talk about post-colonial, imposition. How the people who were proposing this had the hypocrisy, because on the other hand, the same sort of people are very keen on, criticizing neo-colonialism and so on. But that's exactly what they were engaging in. And in that neo-colonialism, they set the framework for the ultimate defeat of the government that they'd imposed.
Right. Going back to reform, because this is what I really wanted this podcast to be about. There have been a number of initiatives, literally in the last few weeks, which have arisen, which are intended to bring about the fabled democratization of the party. So I wanted just to go through those with you and to get your view on them. I mean, one of the main ones is that the party branches, as have been set up, are pilot or interim branches. And we're going very quickly to move on to proper branches where the officers have been elected. So we're doing it there for a number of special general meetings up and down the country, 450 of them or whatever, where the officers will be elected. So am I right in saying that your meeting is already organised?
Yes, in Crewe and Nantwich, we have an SGM on the 31st of this month. The notices have gone out, including the link for people to put their name forward for election to the different officer posts. There will be contested elections for at least some, if not all, of those officer posts. And those members who attend the meeting on the 31st will get to decide who their chairman is, who their deputy chairman, their campaign coordinator, their secretary, and their treasurer. So they will have been party to that. And that's quite right and proper and exactly where we should be going. And I'm very pleased that Crewe and Nantwich is at the leading edge of that, will be, I think it might even be the very first in the Northwest, but
Well, I mean,
if not the first, it's
what
certainly
it
in the
will
initial
do,
tranche.
once you have been appointed, I don't say if you're appointed, once you have been appointed as chair of the branch, it will give you a great deal more authority, won't it? Because it's not you haven't been appointed by, you haven't been selected by someone to run the branch. You've been elected to run it by the members of the branch. That's a different thing altogether, isn't it?
Very much so. And I was going to pick you up on saying the word appointed because I have been appointed up to now.
Yes, that's right, but no
After the
longer.
meeting,
You'll be
the
elected.
person who is elected, whether it be me or somebody else, will have been elected and will have the mandate of being elected. And moving forward, that is the position that the branch should be in.
I remember a few branch meetings ago, a couple of people got up and we had sat, the officers had sat at the front and behind a table in a row, and you could almost sense the meeting thing. Somebody said, "What, who appointed you to?" We didn't introduce ourselves properly, and we didn't handle it very well. But it quite quickly got to the stage where people were starting to question, "Why are you sitting there and I'm sitting here?" And to be honest, wasn't an easy question to answer.
Well, it slightly reflects the rapid growth of the party because when we had a much smaller membership, the members who came to meetings from that base knew that the officers were all people who'd been putting in the hard yards and were there because they'd emerged in that way in the different branches. When our membership went up by four or five times, there were a lot of people in the party that hadn't seen those people putting in the hard yards to get to that post, generally speaking, with the endorsement of their colleagues. And because the numbers were higher, people are more remote from each other, just necessarily, is just a numbers game. And so it's easy to fall into that spot because not all of the people in the audience will necessarily have seen the work you stuck in at the general election. But we can't rely on what we did once. We must be based on what we do now. We need to convince the members that are the members now of the credibility that the candidates have. And of course, time and tide passes on, and someone who may have been the best person a year ago may not be the best person now because either they've slipped off the boil a bit or because somebody else has emerged who's now got the experience to deliver. And that keeps everyone on their toes and delivers the best person for that job, in the view of the electorate that counts, which are the members that they have on the ground.
Yes, it's all good, isn't it? It's all what we want. We want all this to happen, and there may be casualties in the way. If so, then we just have to dust ourselves off and carry on. But I don't think it'll happen. I think in general, it's all going to work out very well. We've
Well,
had
and
the
even if I should just say, it's a question of the tenor of how we do it. We don't want acrimonious situation, but we do want people to have a clear choice. But the ones that are elected need to put their arms around the ones that may not have got through, because they will be capable people who wish to bring something of value to that local branch. And even if they aren't elected, it very much behoves the people who are elected to that new branch team, whether they're new or whether they're replacements, makes no difference. Either way, they'll be letting themselves down at the beginning if they don't reach out to the ones that stood against them and ensure that they have a clear part to play in that branch as it goes forward.
Second thing I was going to say was we have been issued with branch rules, which I presume you've seen.
Yes, I read nothing else. It's a constant companion at my bedside.
And are you comfortable with everything in them?
I think like any rule book, you need to use... They're for the guidance of wise men and the slavish... following of fools, and no rule book can envisage every situation, and so they are necessarily bound to be an evolving thing. And indeed, with the present rules, there are situations that aren't entirely encompassed, so there's supplementary guidance given by the party, and so we need to look at the rules to comply with the rules, and where the rules don't give you every answer, we need to take advice and then follow the supplementary guidance that the party provides.
You mean diverge from them? That's what you mean, Nick.
We clearly wouldn't diverge from the rule.
I'm joking. I'm trying to wait. But no, I mean, I have to say, I read them and I wasn't particularly upset by anything in them, which is good, because usually that's the sort of thing that will upset me. I don't like rules. Yeah. But it wasn't too bad at all. But the other thing that's happening in terms of democratisation is that there are forthcoming elections for the branch representatives to the Reform Board. And this is...
Before we leave the constituency,
yes.
What I think is worth covering is the other places in which democracy is increasingly applying within that branch. And there's two levels that we should be clear about. One of which is the councillors who are selected to stand for different wards.
Mm.
And there we have a two-stage process. So in order to be a candidate with the Reform UK badge against your name on the ballot paper, you have to pass the National Party vetting. But it's not the National Party who decides who can run in a particular ward. They do have to select someone who's passed vetting, but from those candidates who have passed vetting, the branches make the selection. And as increasingly the branches themselves are democratically accounted for, that gives you the voluntary party control over that process. And there are very good reasons why they restrict the number of elected representatives who can remain on the executive of each of the branches. There clearly needs to be communication between the elected Reform councillors and increasingly, hopefully, MPs and the branches, but they are not the voluntary party. It's the voluntary party elected by the members, the chairman, the deputy chairman, etc., etc., who will control the process of who gets to be those elected representatives.
Mm.
And the elected representatives, they all get money in their bank account for fulfilling their roles, and they get the profile, and they're up on the television and so on and so forth. Whereas the ones toiling away at branch level are the ones that are the bedrock of where the party needs to be. And that separation is important. And it's also important in where the whip hand is with the individual members organized into those branches. And it's quite right that that's where the authority should lie. It's like the tea towel. I don't want to offend people on your podcast, but you'll remember which organ of the body on that tea towel ultimately controls things. And it's not the brain, and it's not the lungs, and it's not the muscles. Well, it is a muscle, but it's a muscle that's at the end of the other end of your digestive system. And when the muscle at the other end of your digestive system decided that it was going to seize up, then all of those other organs, the brain, the heart, the liver, and so on, started to feel the effects. So it's the nether regions of your track that rule the roost, and in the same way, it's the grassroots that need to determine who our representatives are. And the same thing will apply with parliamentary candidates.
Mm, yeah.
When we get to select parliamentary candidates, the candidate will first need to become an approved candidate of the party. And they will go away and be given a working over. They'll have to pass an enhanced vetting procedure. they'll be expected to give presentations and deal with media things and be quizzed on their understanding on the policy and so on and so forth. And at the end of that process, they'll either be approved as a candidate or not. If they're not approved as a candidate, they could be told never to darken our doors again, or they could be told try again in a year or two's time, particularly if it may be an issue of maturity in that regard. But they have three possible passes that they can get. They can either be passed as an appropriate candidate anywhere in the country. In old conservative terms, that would be an A-list candidate, you might say. Or they can be passed as someone who's suitable as a candidate anywhere in their region. Or they could be passed as someone who's a suitable candidate for their local area. But when it comes to the selection of a prospective parliamentary candidate, it doesn't matter if they're an A, a B, or a C, because they are all approved by the party to stand in that constituency. And those people will need to put their name forward to the constituency when it is selecting its candidate. And it's the democratic processes underwritten by the members of that constituency that will determine who the parliamentary candidate for that constituency is. Yes, they have to be approved by the party to be an approved candidate status. So the parties now give them that tick, but they also have to have the tick from the members of that branch. And so, in many ways, that's the most important function which those members are fulfilling in that branch is the selection of our parliamentary candidates. Because unlike some other parties, it will help to ensure that the candidates that we put forward for election at Parliament understand that they're there because they have been selected by those members, and that when they go to Westminster, they are there to represent those members from within that constituency and indeed the electorate of that constituency more generally. And they're beholden to them rather than to anyone else in the rest of the country. And that's right and proper.
Yeah, that all sounds eminently sensible. It really does. It sounds as if it's the right way to do it. Now, moving on, though, there is also the election, an election coming up for the three vacancies on the Reform Board, which have been allocated to people coming from the grassroots, from the branches. And I have heard a little whisper that you may be a candidate for this.
Well, I have indeed thrown my hat into the ring, although in common with the other candidates, and the deadline was just at the end of last week, I haven't yet completed the
The
vetting
process,
process.
yeah.
And the outcome of that, as to whether I can go forward as a candidate, will become apparent on Monday. So just a day or two's time. And then all the candidates that have passed that stage will need to go out and get a proposer and a seconder who can be any member of good standing in the party, but obviously someone who knows that candidate and is prepared to vouch for them as a proper candidate. But they will also need to all receive the endorsement of a minimum of 10 branch chairman. And so I'm quite sure right now the candidates or those people who wish to be candidates will have been soliciting the endorsement of chairman. I have to confess, I have made a number of phone calls to see where the land lies. But as long as the candidates get through vetting and they can get the 10 endorsements, and they've got their proposer and seconder, they will then go forward to the following stage, which is due to start on the 30th of this month. I mean, the actual end of the endorsement stage is actually technically the 29th, and it'll become apparent from that who has passed that stage and therefore who is running. But then on the 30th, that is when the green light is given to starting the actual campaign. And all of the candidates will then be doing everything they can to go to members, either physically through branch meetings or remotely through social media, through blog posts, through whatever other mechanism they can think of to raise their name in lights amongst the electorate, which are the 230,000 members of Reform. And they've really got 2 weeks to elevate their profile amongst that electorate and to convince people they're the right person. And that that process culminates in a national set of hustings, which will be on the 14th of August, when the party will gather all those candidates together, and hopefully the numbers will have come down a bit by that stage, so it will be manageable. But those candidates will be assembled and they will make their pitch. And that will be live streamed so that any party member can see it and form their own opinion based on how those candidates present their case. And then following that, for the next 7 days, i.e. from the 14th of August to the 21st of August, while campaigning can continue, the ballot is open and it's being run electronically through a third party who specialise in running votes for organisations. And so that's when they'll have received it in their email inbox, so please do check your spam. The 230,000 members and those who have been members for a minimum of 3 months will be able to cast their vote. And then on the 21st of August, those votes will be counted. They get three votes because there are three slots. So there's a maximum potential of 690,000 votes if every member voted three times to be distributed amongst the candidates. And from that, it is first past the post. So the person who gets most of those 630,000 votes will be elected first. Then the one who gets second will be second, and the one who's third is third. It's extremely unlikely there should be a tie. If you've got an electorate of 630,000, I don't believe.
I don't think that's going to happen.
Right. But if it did happen, I believe the process is a flick of the coin.
So, two things, Nick. First of all, can I say how brave it is of you to announce your candidature here when you don't even know if you've got through the first phase or not? So that's brave. Secondly, I will be sending this podcast to the chair of every branch that I know. I'll distribute it as widely as I possibly can. So would you like to take a minute to tell us why you would be the person that we should vote for?
Yes. The reason that I think people should vote for me is that I have the hard yards in a local branch. In fact, more than one local branch, in both Crewe and Nantwich. And I've also been running for ill or for otherwise the two branches that I was involved with during the general election, which is Chester North and Neston and Ellesmere Port and Bromborough. And so I understand intimately how the shoe can pinch in terms of the relationship between head office and individual branches and the challenges that face people at the grassroots. And that's what I think needs to be projected into the deliberations of the board. In any large organization, you do get different perspectives from head office than you do at the grassroots level. And I challenge people to think of any large organization where that isn't true. So I'm not pointing fingers at Reform because it is just symptomatic of larger organizations. But those organizations that can transcend that gap best are those that will prosper most. And so by putting this mechanism in place, Reform is giving itself the vehicle by which the genuine concerns of grassroots can be projected into those national deliberations, which makes it more likely that we will succeed and elect a Reform government under Nigel Farage in 2028 or 2029. This is not appointing people to a board where there are going to be rows and dissension about this or that. It's about appointing people who are going to work collaboratively to help the party to improve its decision making because they are armed with the information as to how things are looking from a grassroots level. And I've been involved in the party since the inception. I stood for the Brexit Party in 2019. I stood for Reform UK to be a police and crime commissioner in 2020. I stood again in 2024 for Parliament under the Reform UK banner. And again, I've stood for borough councillor since then in the period immediately after Parliament. So I have also been engaged in running multiple branches, and I visit many branches and speak to them because I want to support those other branches and because I love doing that. And for those reasons, and my long experience in working in politics, originally for a different party, but nevertheless at the grassroots level, that I bring a level of experience to it that I think will add value. And that is why people should vote for me.
Good. Well, I mean, I have to say that what we need is this conduit, don't we? We need this conduit from the grassroots up to the top of the party. And I have to say, I can think of no better person to do it than you, Nick, because you've got all the credentials. So I wish you well.
Adding to that, those who look at my CV will see that I had 20-odd years as a political lobbyist. Now, in working as a political lobbyist, there are some campaigns that you win by brute force, by assembling coalitions and media campaigns and so on. But they're generally not the ones that deliver in the best time scale or at all. And they're generally a sign that you've probably not started in the best position. In those lobbying campaigns that I led for various issues relating to small businesses, it's the ones that I was able to win by influencing those with decision-making authority behind the scenes, by showing them why it was in their interests to adopt policy in a particular way, that were the most successful. And when it comes to working on encouraging the party to reflect where the shoe is pinching tightest, it's precisely those skills of working collaboratively rather than in antagonism with the people we're engaging with that are vital to ensuring that an outcome is good for everyone. And so that is another aspect of my past which I think will be particularly useful in this role.
Yes, you wouldn't want the people who've been elected from the branches to be in conflict with the people who have appointed themselves or have been appointed by the leadership. That would be a disaster.
Absolutely. This is all about making it more likely to deliver a reform government in 2028 or 2029, probably, under Nigel Farage. That can change this country for the better and deliver the changes which the population and particularly our supporters are crying out for, and which is essential for a rebirth in the country, because this can again be the greatest country on earth. And the only thing that is stopping us is the shackles that we've placed on ourselves, that the uni party has placed on the country, because the unbridled capacity of the British people is such that we have revolutionized the whole world. If you look at pretty well every aspect of modern society, the fantastic reduction in poverty over the last 100-150 years, at the increasing rule of law across the world, and almost everything good in science, in arts, in education, Britain has been at the leading edge. And if it's not Britain, it's countries who have taken their culture and values from Britain. And it's a crying shame that Britain has allowed itself to be talked down, to be talked down by itself and be curtailed by itself. And that's why I feel so passionately that we have to deliver a reform government, and why I want to be the very best contributor to that that I can be.
Good. Well, I mean, I think a lot of people feel like that, that if reform don't get in 2029 or whatever it is, then the project is too important to mess up. We can't afford to mess it up. We have to do it because it will literally save our country. And
Very much so. And then we could look forward to a bright future. Not to say the road will not be bumpy, because there is so much accumulated rubbish in the
but
way.
I think we'll sweep all that away pretty quickly. I think you know, there will be it won't be easy. There'll be have to be we have to be tough to do it, but we will be able to sweep most of it away, I'm certain.
I agree with that. And I actually think the process will be part of it, because when the people can see that we have a leader and a party that is moving us in a positive direction and have clarity on their goals for where the country needs to go to, the population will respond to that in a way that actually enhances the process. And it's that process, necessarily, rather than dealing with all the individual issues, which will propel us forward.
Good. Well, look, thanks very much indeed for being on the podcast again, Nick. I've enjoyed talking to you. I appreciate it. It's going to be very interesting to see how this democracy works out in the next few weeks and months. And I wish you every success and I wish you well.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.